we saw a tremendous amount of methane coming out of these lakes, especially lakes where permafrost is thawing for the first time since the last ice age.
Studying a potent greenhouse gas from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 31st of August. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Stryker Brigade families welcome the end of a long deployment.
Having to do everything on my own, you know, taking care of the car and the kid and all of that good stuff.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Great weekdays begin with the most up-to-date local news and information on APRN's Alaska Morning News. The Alaska Morning News, the news you wake up to.
The climate has been warming faster than computer models said it would. This could be because some important details have been left out of the models, particularly details about feedbacks. When warming causes changes, which then causes more warming. For instance, nobody is really sure how much methane gas is being released by melting permafrost. But as APRN's Steve Heimel reports, there are efforts underway to answer that question.
Everybody knows carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. It lets light come in, but it keeps heat from escaping the planet. And many people know that methane, a common gas emitted by termites and livestock and swamps, is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. But how much more potent?
Its effectiveness as a greenhouse gas is 25 times greater than it is than CO2. So we're particularly worried about methane.
That's Colm Sweeney. It's his job to assemble measurements of methane from all over the world for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Earth Systems Research Laboratory in Colorado. They put equipment aboard planes to take samples and spectrometer readings of atmospheric composition. Lately, they've been paying particular attention to the Arctic because of reports that increasing amounts of methane are bubbling up out of lakes and tundra pools. The permafrost is melting and decomposing at an unknown rate. They've been taking measurements at Barrow for decades, but have had no way to know where the methane they were measuring was coming from. Now, a Coast Guard C-130 out of Kodiak is carrying sampling and methane measuring equipment when it flies to the Arctic every couple of weeks since April.
We see increases in gases, you know, during the summer for methane and during the winter for CO2, but we don't know if that's any different than it was, 100 years ago. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to do now is establish that baseline.
Because this is the first year, there's nothing to compare the plane's measurements with yet. But still, Sweeney thinks he's got enough data to put together a report on the state of the world's methane by this coming December. Sweeney says he did ask the Coast Guard to revise its flight path to target the most likely areas for measurements of methane.
I sort of asked them to make a profile south of the Brooks Range where we actually expect much greater melting to happen during the summer time, as opposed to north of the Brooks Range where we don't expect to see huge amounts of change yet because the summertime temperatures are just not enough to see huge changes.
According to ecologist Ted Shore of the University of Florida, the amount of carbon stored in the existing permafrost is more than the total emissions of human activities since the Industrial Revolution. So any change in its decomposition rate could be significant. But the dynamics of permafrost melt are so complex that they don't lend themselves very well to computer modeling. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Katie Walter has spent a lot of time thinking about the complex dynamics of melting permafrost. The University of Alaska professor camped out with a dozen other scientists on the Seward Peninsula last spring to study the amount of methane and other carbon that is being released into the atmosphere as the permafrost thaws. She says the most exciting moments came when the researchers used GPS to return to exact locations where they had been found methane seeping out of lakes in the fall.
So we took our shovels out and dug the snow out, and we found great big pockets of methane in the ice and collected that gas. But in the collection process, you also get to ignite it. And it was really interesting to find it again in the springtime and see just how much gas was stored in the ice all winter. We had huge explosions. three of us burned our the hair on our head from these methane explosions.
Walter has done most of her work in Siberia, where the frozen landscape is similar to Alaska, but she says the warming seems to be happening faster in Alaska.
It seems to me that permafrost is thawing faster here than some of the places I've worked in Siberia, but we don't have quantitative results yet. We're working on that. We saw a tremendous amount of methane coming out of these lakes in, on the northern Sird Peninsula, especially lakes where permafrost is thawing for the first time since the last ice age.
Walter's team used motorized drills with augers to pull core samples from lake bottoms and drained lake basins. They will use them to try to understand how stable the permafrost is to help get a sense of how much its melting may contribute to global warming in the years ahead. Fort Wainwright welcomed around 500 soldiers back from Iraq over the weekend. The Stryker Brigade is returning to Fairbanks after a year-long deployment. An Army press release says the 4,000 members brigade worked in the Diyala province north of Baghdad, battling terrorists and insurgents and supporting an Iraqi election and working with local security forces. KUAC's Dan Bross was there for the arrival of a Stryker group over the weekend, and he filed this report.
The largest group of Stryker soldiers to come back so far, over 280 strong, marched into a hangar at Fort Wainwright Saturday night. After briefly standing in formation, the soldiers were dismissed and engulfed by a mass of family and friends. Specialist Scott McCray, who was greeted by his wife, expressed happiness to be home and a sense of accomplishment about the Stryker's mission in Iraq.
We was the last of deployment to hand everything over to the Iraqis before we come over. Everybody, most of our guys made it back safe. That was probably the best thing about the whole thing.
Saturday's return flight timing could not have been better for fellow specialist Sylvester Dima, whose September 29th arrival coincided with his youngest son's birthday. Dima says the year away has been tough on his family.
They always ask my wife, where's Papa, where's Papa? And my wife always say, oh, yeah, like a couple more weeks. But, you know, children, they really feel like only a couple of days. So they feel like, oh, Mommy, you don't believe, Mommy. And I think today it's a really happy day for me. And this is a special day for my young boy. He's a birthday 4 years today. And he told me, Papa, you're going to be home my birthday. I know that one, Papa. And I didn't know, I never know that one. And yeah, I made it. This is a birthday present. Happy birthday for you, okay?
Family members displayed a mix of happiness and relief to have their soldiers safely home. Some say they've held it together pretty well during the year-long deployment, while others, like Tracy Villanueva, say it was tough.
Having to do everything on my own, you know, taking care of the car and the kid and all of that good stuff. We had to move in the middle, so I had to do all that on my own, and it was pretty rough.
Villanueva says the family plans to enjoy the fall together with trips to Denali and Valdez, as well as projects around the house she's been saving for her husband. Villanueva's son, Anthony, says he's looking forward to getting back to the regular routine with his dad.
I'm used to getting up in the morning and him being downstairs making coffee, so I'll probably get up around the same time he does and just bother him all day long till I have to go to bed.
Not all soldiers have spouses and kids waiting for them. Some are greeted by friends on post, and for a few, there are special guests on hand who've traveled to Alaska to greet them. Don and Fran Lowry drove 4,400 miles from Illinois to welcome home their grandson.
His parents were not able to come, so we had the opportunity. We brought his vehicle up for him, some of his personal effects, and we're just happy to be here. We've enjoyed our visit here in your community a lot. We spent the last week. Originally, we thought that he would be in possibly the first of the week, but we're just happy that he's here tonight, or coming in tonight, so.
The Lowrys say their grandson is following a family tradition of serving in the military. The initial elation soldiers and their families experience with homecoming can be followed by challenges as they readjust. Army wife Heather Keppel says she's glad to have her husband home and tries to make the transition as smooth as possible.
I pretty much handle the household and I don't mind. I want his work to be less stressful on him when he comes home. But just knowing that he's there every day, that I can just be like, you know, this is what happened today, and he can share in the emotion and the stress with me without having to actually deal with it himself. So it'll be great to be able to talk to somebody every day.
Keppel says the family has an immediate challenge on the horizon. They're relocating to a new post in Colorado after 8 years at Fort Wainwright. All soldiers returning from Iraq get 72 hours off before taking 7 days of reintegration training. That includes everything from physical and psychological checkups to winter driving instruction. About a quarter of the 4,000-member Stryker Brigade is expected to be back at Fort Wainwright by Tuesday. The rest of the brigade is scheduled to arrive by the end of September. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, swimming the frigid ocean waters of Southeast.
It was colder than I was hoping, and there were many more jellyfish than I was hoping.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Rural Alaskans have suffered in recent years from nature, the national economy, and from what people there see as an unresponsive state government. For the last year, the complaints have become more vocal with phone calls and letters to the government officials and the media. The new Parnell administration hopes to develop a better relationship in the bush with the Rural Action Subcabinet. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Attorney General Daniel Sullivan is chairman of the Rural Action Subcabinet, a group of 9 members of the governor's full cabinet assembled by administrative order last December. In that order, the subcabinet was told to study the problems in rural Alaska and to advise the governor on what to do. Sullivan says the instructions boil down to a key underlying principle: how to improve life in rural Alaska. And it starts with public input, opening the process.
You're going to see commissioners traveling to rural communities this fall. Certainly I will be, and I know some of my colleagues will be. When we do that, the plan would be to have really just public hearings, much more public input. We can tell them what we're thinking, some ideas that we've gotten from the advisory committee members, and some of the ideas that we've been thinking about. But getting that input from them, I think, is critical.
Sullivan says he's already begun to meet with Native and community leaders. He's also set up a liaison, assistant attorneys general working within his own office to focus on rural issues. And he has an email address where he would welcome public input. That's at attorney.general@alaska.gov.
And the goal is, this fall, to be focused on these issues, open up the process more for public input, and then hopefully with regard to the rural subcabinet, with regard to our advisory committee, and with regard to the input we're getting from the public, is to be able to have recommendations on some of these issues for the governor's office by December.
Sullivan says since it was established, the subcabinet has studied the declining population in rural Alaska, with a new report citing many reasons for the drop. It's also begun looking for reasons for high fuel costs in rural areas. Those were specifically assigned in the administrative order creating the group. He justifies the studies by saying an understanding of the problem is the first step toward solving it. The subcabinet's also working on contingency plans for fuel supplies this winter. On the table are also the coordination of job training programs, best value procurement that would improve such things as cost, delivery, and training, and connecting communities that want to participate to improve their local services, energy, and commerce. He says the subcabinet works best across departmental borders, members coordinating their own work with other agencies in other departments. As for improving the life of rural Alaskans,
the proof will be in the pudding, and we recognize that. And not, but I do think you, as I mentioned, you have an administration that's committed to these issues.
The administrative trips to rural areas will begin in mid-September, with details coming soon. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Despite a drop in visitors to the Kenai Peninsula this summer, hopes for tourism in the future remain optimistic. KBBI's Marsha Lin reports.
The discussion began rather bleakly.
2009 numbers are not looking good, and the prediction is that 2010 is going to be worse.
That was Shannon Hamrick, director of the Kenai Peninsula Tourism Marketing Council. She recently attended a conference in Anchorage that looked at the tourism industry in South Central Alaska. Linda Broadhead of the Homer Visitor Center says she's seen fewer people this summer and they're seeking lower-cost recreational opportunities.
They're doing much more things on their own, taking advantage of a lot of the hiking opportunities, and a lot of people have been bringing their own boats down, too. I know it's impacted our fishing industry here, our charter fishing industry.
It appears that more Alaskans are getting out to see what the state has to offer, says Tina Day, director of the Homer Chamber of Commerce.
I see a much more focus this year on reaching out to those local Alaskans. So I think that's a little bit relative to why maybe the visitor center numbers are down, because those folks that are coming in that already know Homer, have been here before, are less likely to stop into the visitor center across the peninsula than because they know where they want to go.
Taking a proactive stance on the situation to find new tourism opportunities is a challenge. Natasha Alla, director of the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center, believes it's important to do broader outreach.
Alaska really is a global international destination, and this year we did some marketing in Germany, and I think that just thinking international, not just thinking in our backyard, really looking at ourselves as an international destination and marketing ourselves globally.
The panel discussed exploring more winter activities, theme-focused tour packages, and experiences like going out on a commercial fishing boat. Hamrick says visitors want a taste of the real Alaska.
They want to come to Alaska. They want to feel like they've lived it, they've experienced it, they've gotten dirty, they've gotten wet. And we need to start thinking out of the box. And those types of experiences are going to set us apart, and they're going to draw people here, and they're going to leave and tell all their friends and family about the amazing experience they had.
She also noted that Alaska ranks 39th in terms of what the state spends on tourism marketing,
which just seems ridiculous to me, considering we are probably the number one destination in America for visitors.
Funding from local governments is important as well. Day says despite budget cuts, tourism is a part of local economies that can't be overlooked.
They really have to take home and understand that message about how the nonprofits leverage those dollars and are able to, you know, go after matching grants and that type of thing. It's really important because, you know, the chambers and KPTMC are those organizations that can leverage those marketing dollars that small businesses just can't do.
Business owners also need to be cautious about cutting marketing dollars, warns Broadhead.
But don't cut your throat by cutting your advertising dollar to the point that you're not getting the word out about your business. That always seems to be the easiest dollar to cut, and it can sometimes be the most costly.
The discussion ended on an optimistic note from Natasha Alla.
I think we just need to keep focused past this recession period that we're in. We will get through this, and we need to keep focused 3-5 years out and realize Alaska is on a lot of people's bucket list. People have not forgotten about Alaska, and they still want to come here.
Despite the gloomy forecast for tourism next summer, Homer is expecting more cruise ship visitors, with one ship planning 9 visits. In Homer, I'm Marsha Lin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
A Denali area education group is benefiting from an alternative energy project. The largest solar hot water heater in the state went online this summer at the Denali Education Center in McKinley Village. Center Director Jody Rodwell says the system will provide substantial savings.
We're estimating that it will lower our energy costs by up to $10,000 in the summertime. So our fossil fuel energy consumption will definitely decrease, and hopefully we'll sustain our business throughout the summer during our May through September season.
Rodwell says the solar water heater serves 17 guest cabins, staff facilities, and a commercial kitchen. Golden Valley Electric owns and operates the 40 by 50 foot solar array, which was built with a grant from the Alaska Energy Authority. GVEA's Todd Honer says solar power is a good match with the Alaska visitor industry.
The best thing about this is not only is it hitting an industry that does have an inverted peak from what most Alaskans do, where we use more in the wintertime, this is a great thing that can not only reduce their costs, but it sort of demonstrates a sustainable power source that's very attractive to a lot of people coming up here from the lower 48.
The center's Rodwell says the solar hot water heater will also provide a teaching tool for a planned course on solar energy. As the salmon processing season winds down in Petersburg, visiting workers from the U.S. and around the world will prepare to head home. For some, it's a one-year experience. Others come back summer after summer, and some decide to settle there. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein recently visited with workers at the Trident Seafood Plant in Petersburg and produced this audio postcard.
I'm Denise. I'm from Turkey.
Tell me about how long you've been working in Petersburg.
It's my third season. I came here at June, and then maybe end of September I'm going to go back to Turkey. I'm working at freezer department, and I'm taking care of computer and labels and paperwork, like that.
Well, you've obviously come back for a third year. What keeps you coming back?
I like this job. I'm studying fisheries in Turkey, and it's my job. And I like to be here. And I know this plant, Petersburg plant.
Oh, well, my name is Ernesto Pedro Sandoval. I am from Guadalajara. I've been working here since 2000. I come here every June, and I stay till October. I mean, late September. Recently, I've been doing sanitation.
And what brought you up here to work originally? Just heard about it from folks to come up and work in Alaska?
Well, I was in Guadalajara, in fact, and I heard in the radio that there was a guy in another state hiring people to come over here. So I just went to that small town, and I had an interview, and he sent me here.
What keeps you coming back?
I don't know.
My name is Morgan Longwell, and from Bellingham, Washington.
What brought you up to work in the cold storage?
Summer work, money.
Did you have other options you were considering? Like, is there something that made you want to do the Alaska thing?
I've never been to Alaska before. It was the main thing. It's just the adventure coming up here. Not quite all the way north, though, so.
You weren't ready to go to, like, Nome or something,
right?
Like that.
Yeah.
So what are you thinking? Is it a good summer for you? Are you thinking about coming back, or you're not sure yet?
I'd probably come back next year, yeah. It was pretty easy to get into it, so.
What were you doing here in the plant again?
Working the egg house, brining eggs, making caviar.
Did you get to eat some?
I did.
What'd you think?
Not for me.
Well, my name's Emmanuel Ramos. I come from the Yakima Valley down in Washington State. I'm the case-up lead. All the eggs, the salmon roe that we get, after being processed and packaged, I'm in charge of casing them up and shipping them out, keeping detailed records on everything that gets shipped out of here.
What brought you up to Alaska to work? Is this you've been here a couple
it's
years?
Second year. First year was just kind of like, get away. Alaska, man, last frontier. You want to come up here, right? Plus, I heard the ladies were pretty hot.
How's it worked out for you?
I loved it. Second year, because I was bilingual, got the supervisor position pretty quick, and I think I'll be coming back. I'm in college right now, so it also helps out with paying the bills.
Whether you call it marathon, cold water, or even naked swimming, immersing ourselves without any dry or wetsuit in the frigid Pacific Ocean water is something most Alaskans generally try to avoid. Not the case, though, for visiting cold water swimmer Claudia Rose, who completed a challenging swim across Sitka Sound recently. KCAW's Chris Todd reports.
We say in San Diego that the cold water freezes your brain, and then you think it's a good idea.
That's Claudia Rose explaining what drives people like her to spend her time not on the ocean, but in the ocean. Rose is a 45-year-old engineer from San Diego and was forced to give up running about 5 years ago. A lifelong swimmer, she took to the water for exercise, which over the years has morphed into cold water marathons in California, Nevada, and Southeast Alaska. The ocean was 54 degrees on the day that Rose chose to swim across Sitka Sound, a body of open ocean water that narrows to inner channels, strewn with rock piles, surging tidal currents, and all manner of sea life.
I guess when I got here, it already looked like it was going to be harder than it looked like on the chart. It was colder than I was hoping, and there were many more jellyfish than I was hoping. Though the real surprise was when we went over to cruise off, I went to Shoals Point, where I thought of starting originally, and it was so exposed, and the swell was so big, and it was foggy, and I couldn't see the other side.
This wasn't her first plunge into Southeast Alaskan waters. She's participated 3 times in the Pinnock Island Challenge, a yearly diabetes fundraiser in Ketchikan. In fact, Rose had just finished up that Ketchikan swim a few days before her Sitka endeavor and admits to being a little tired after racking up over 16 miles of official cold water swimming in less than a week. And that doesn't count the practice swimming. By the way, did I mention she doesn't wear any dry suit, just a swimsuit, a cap, and some goggles? That is Dee Ricker for cold water or naked swimmers, as these folks are sometimes called. They can, however, and Rose did, use a gel sort of coating on her skin that helps to protect her. She says it only lasts about the first hour of the swim, though. Then it's just the ocean, the swimmer, and the jellyfish.
It was the day before we swam at Old Sitka Rocks, and I ran into a few jellyfish there. You had a bunch of lion's mane jellyfish this year, which stings, so I saw them and thought, well, maybe they're just on the edge, but it turns out they're pretty solid all the way across the sound. The lion's mane have really long tentacles, so for a while I was dodging around them. Ralph was checking to see if I was losing concentration or getting cold or why I was doing that, and I told him it looked like a jellyfish tank like we have in the aquarium. And there seem to be these little tiny white ones. There's these moon jellies, and there's the lion's mane. So I was trying to get just around those. By Middle Island, I had crashed into a couple of them without seeing them. On the other hand, the water was pretty cold. It was 54 degrees when we started. And hitting the jellyfish distracted me from the cold water. But there were lots of sea otters, too. And the sea otters were talking to us and swimming, ducking down and up. And so there were a lot of other interesting things to see. I even thought the white jellyfish were pleasant to look at.
Rose says she has some amazing sea life encounters like the one off the coast of California a couple of years ago.
I had 3 fin whales follow me for an hour, and those are 70-foot whales, and that was one of the stranger things I've seen. There was one time when there was one on each side, one in the front. We had a 60-foot dive boat following us across the channel. Whales are bigger than it, and I'm thinking, if anything moves, I'm going to get crushed.
Rose had her road crew along with her during her recent swim. Her partner, Al Brenner, and Sitkin John Dunlap followed along in a skiff as a support craft. Fellow San Diegan Ralph Lufkin was close by in his kayak, providing food and water to Rose every 15 or 20 minutes and chatting her up to be sure she wasn't becoming hypothermic. Rose says she cold water swims to encourage others to do the same, and will likely return to Sitka next year. There's already talk around town that a cold water swim club is now in the works, with the possibility of a cold swimming fundraiser for charity.
That was KCAW's Chris Todd reporting from Sitka. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of our tonight's stories, we are online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Marsha Lynn in Homer, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Chris Todd in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.